This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Ratchford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this, which is our penultimate live show for Healthy Rounds. My guest today is going to be Dr. Jim O'Day. Now, Dr. O'Day has been a frequent guest on our program. He's a senior vice president for the Behavioral Health Network at Hartford Healthcare. He's a clinical psychologist by his profession, and he's been a trusted resource for this show. So I wanted to make sure I got him on before we wrap things up. You know, Jim O'Day and I have worked together in some capacity since 1989, and really over the last 36 years, he has been the go-to guy. We were together at Backus Hospital and now again at Hartford Healthcare. So I wanted to get his perspective on mental health in the United States today. Let's take a little bit more of a global look at mental health. Now, I've appreciated many well-wishers and people getting back to me and sorry that we're ending the program. I want to be clear that I'm ending the program because and I know it sounds cliche to spend more time with my family, but specifically, Saturday mornings have become a very active time for my grandchildren. This year, I didn't even get to one of my grandson's flag football games. We have hockey games. We've got dance recital. We've got a lot going on here in the Alessi household. So I needed to get to something that was a little bit more time manageable. And I found that. What I want to do is continue this conversation that I feel we've been having the past 16 years, me and all of you, and providing health information. Not just that, but I think it's become crucial now with so much misinformation and disinformation. So starting in January, I'm going to be doing a podcast. And the podcast will be posted on my website, alessimd.com. So many of you use the info@alessimd.com email, but if you just go to alessimd.com, you will see my website that I share with my daughters. There'll be a box there right on the front page. You click on it, and you'll get the podcast. It's not going to be this big national Apple or Odyssey-type podcast. It's a conversation with all of you. And to provide you with good information, it's going to be there every other week to start, and we'll get that going. So I'm not retiring, not leaving the media world, but we're just going to a different medium for a while, and we'll see how that works out. This day in medicine, November 8th. In 1847, Dr. James Young Simpson first used chloroform on an obstetrical patient, Wilhelmina Carstairs, who was the daughter of a physician. You know, in 1895, William Röntgen. Now, we know that name from the X-rays, right? That's how you measure radiation. He was the first to really use X-rays clinically. And on November 8th in 1895, he did an X-ray of his own hand. So it's interesting because the first one, Wilhelmina Carstairs, who got the chloroform, was the daughter of a physician. And here is Röntgen taking X-rays of his own hand. So I guess the best subjects for these experiments were family members or yourself. But in 1922 is when Dr. Christian Barnard was born on this day. And many of you know his name, being the South African heart surgeon who became famous for performing the first heart transplant. But without further ado, listen, we need to get to the clown show we have going on in Washington, D.C. And by that, I mean what is now the 38th day of a government shutdown. Who could imagine this? And on top of this clown show, we've got the Oz-Kennedy duo, okay? Dr. Mehmet Oz and R.F. Kane Jr. They're like Laurel and Hardy or Abbott and Costello, and you just can't make it up. Here we have Kennedy, right? He is now the head, Secretary of Health and Human Services. And he's got such great ideas here. He has now started an investigation in looking at windmills, the windmills that are used to generate energy. And he wants to look at how they might be causing cancer. So he's moving the full power of the CDC to study the alleged harms of offshore windmills. Meanwhile, they have taken funding away from the CDC's ability to prevent injuries like drowning, traumatic brain injury, falls. The things that affect people the most, we are not emphasizing anymore. That's the way this show's going. He's even talking about circumcision being a cause of autism because a child might get Tylenol for pain. And which, by the way, I have a son-in-law who's a pediatrician, and they don't give them Tylenol at the time of the circumcision. But regardless of that, that's where his stupidity is directed. They're even beginning to defund occupational health and safety. So now we move over to the other half of this comedy duo, Dr. Mehmet Oz, right? So here's what he's done, all right? He's in this job now 10 months, and now we're going to reduce the cost of weight loss drugs. Now, I don't know if he doesn't know how to use a calculator. He must have a staff there who research his numbers or who own a calculator. But based on his calculations, every American in the United States will now lose 353 pounds in the next 10 years. So, guys, just thanks for the material, okay? But you are taking this country's health in a non-serious matter. This is serious business. And that brings me on to a topic I really wanted to talk today because it came to mind. The Dallas Cowboys defensive end Marshawn Nealand died by an apparent suicide this week. Now, I don't know Marshawn Nealand, but I know people are dying of suicide and they're using guns. We've got a problem in this country between guns and mass shootings and mental health. Now, if you talk to people like myself, I think guns are a problem. If you talk to people in favor of everybody having a gun, they say it's a mental health problem. I don't care which side of the coin you're on. All I'm saying is to the people in Washington, do something about it. You either restrict gun sales or you invest in mental health. Instead, they have let gun sales run rampant in this country by people who are unlicensed, who have no idea, they're underage. They let that go. And on the other side, instead of doing something about mental health, since they're alarmed at the mental health problem, they started to defund mental health in this country. You don't have to be a Phi Beta Kappa here to figure out that you need to do something on either side of the equation if you're going to have some success. So let's look at Baltimore. You know, Baltimore has been a city that's been absolutely vilified by the president and other people. And heck, I remember the movies, right? There's shows Homicide, The Streets of Baltimore, The Wire, okay? And that was the case in Baltimore. But no one has been looking at the fact that Baltimore took a public health approach to homicides. They have reduced homicides. They had 8 consecutive years of more than 300 homicides in that city. And it stopped when their new mayor, Brandon Scott, took office in 2020. And since 2020, their numbers have gone down. Even in the last year. Last year, at the end of July, they had 111 homicides in 2024. So far this year, it's down to 84. They've taken the total number of homicides down to less than 200 by taking a public health approach. What does that mean? A perfect example would be, say you have salmonella in meat, right? You don't stop selling every piece of meat in the country. What you do is you get to the source and you stop it at the source. That's a public health approach. When it came to gun violence, you don't arrest everybody who you think may have a gun, because that's what we did, right? Zero tolerance. That's what they did in Baltimore for years. It didn't work. Instead, they used their knowledge and statistics to find out where most of these homicides were occurring. And they reached out to the people who statistically were more likely to either die or commit a crime with a gun. And they sent them a letter. They actually sent these people letters to tell them, we are here to help you, because if you keep going this way, you will die, members of your family will die. And believe it or not, 94% of the people who got that letter came forward to say, what can you do to help? And that gave birth to the group violence reduction strategy. And it's a whole strategy they did in Baltimore. They stopped these ghost guns. They started suing the companies that make these polymer guns that you can't trace. They stopped the flow of guns into their city. And they met with these people and offered them opportunities they didn't have before. That's how the number of homicides went down. Those who didn't, when you look at the statistics, the people who didn't participate, that at-risk group that didn't participate, most of them ended up in jail or dead. So people were looking around. So it's taken a huge mark. But yet, nevertheless, in the past year, our president has said it's a terrible place. Instead of going there and learning what they're doing right. That's what we need. We need to take more of a public health approach to our problems. And we certainly have a lot of them. We don't have time today, but next week we're going to talk a lot about this Affordable Care Act and how the lack of subsidy for that is going to affect everybody. And let's not forget SNAP. Right? People are still going hungry in the United States. So we've got problems that can be solved. And if we are as great as we think we are, we should be out there solving those problems now. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest and friend, Dr. Jim O'Day, Senior Vice President for Behavioral Health Network over at Hartford Healthcare. We're going to be talking about some of the issues I brought up already, mental health and the delivery of mental health care in the United States. If you have questions for Dr. O'Day, you can reach out at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080.
We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce as my guest today, Dr. Jim O'Day. And he has been such a trusted expert in the field of clinical psychology, and he's a senior VP of the Behavioral Health Network at Hartford Healthcare. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Tony. It's a pleasure to spend time with you and your audience.
I feel like I should be doing this show on a treadmill because I have to lose 353 pounds before the midterms next November. But in the interim, we might as well get to it. Jim, one of the topics I've always touched on and heard about, and that's volunteerism. The ability to go out and volunteer and share, it gives you such a good feeling, but is it a great psychological effect that you have from going out and volunteering in your community?
Yeah. First off, it's a great question. I want to thank you again for being a guest on this amazing show. And on behalf of the audience, Tony, I want to thank you for being just a common sense educator about so many medical issues. We're really fortunate and look forward to your continued contributions to our communities. To this question, it definitely has a positive impact on people's mental health. I was at work yesterday, actually, and I just happened to talk to two people, one of whom talked about their work volunteering for the Board of Education in Meriden, Connecticut. like this is a volunteer opportunity, but it's something that moves them, something that they feel that they have an opportunity to contribute to the educational needs of the children here in Meriden. Another colleague said, I started at Hartford Healthcare as a volunteer 11 years ago and now have been employed in the organization. You know, it connects people to a greater sense of fulfillment and meaning in their personal lives.
So, you know, how do people go about it? So you've given some examples. How should they go about volunteering? And have there been studies done on this, Jim?
Yeah, there's definitely been a lot of studies, and it's clear that there's a connectedness between greater social engagement and social involvement with members of your community and your faith community. There's really no wrong way to do it. I would just say you have to get started. And so whether that means volunteering at a local soup kitchen or reading to kids at a local library, I think if people just do something and then they'll find themselves getting attracted to something that feels like, wow, this is really working for me. I look forward to it. It's something that is a highlight of my week. So there's really no wrong way. The only wrong way is not engaging and getting started. And people sometimes wait for the perfect opportunity. There's no perfect opportunity. The most important thing is to get started.
Jim, I used as the example, kind of getting into this topic, that of Marshawn Kneeland, who's a Dallas Cowboy, somebody who, everybody say, had everything going for him, and suddenly dies by suicide. Are we making any progress with regard to suicide and suicide prevention?
You know, I think the literature and the research tells us the results are mixed, actually. You know, I think there is a greater awareness of the penetration, if you will, of mental illness in the general community. Unfortunately, people just wait too long before they access mental health care. And as a result of waiting too long, the symptoms become more and more entrenched. As the symptoms become more and more entrenched, people resist the likelihood of going out and getting treatment. I mean, there are some real strategies that will make a difference in terms of getting upstream, in terms of addressing symptoms when they're seen early. Screening works. You know, behavioral health and psychiatric screening for depression, anxiety disorders, substance use conditions. Like, we know it works for breast cancer. We know it works for colon cancer. It works for mental health as well. We just have to do a far better job of screening people early, Tony.
You know, now in the office, we use this PHQ-9. Is that an effective way of screening people for these problems, that questionnaire that we've started to really incorporate in our Epic electronic record?
It's a start. I think it's a good tool. I think more importantly, the issue is that if you're doing the screening tool, what it really should result in is the beginning of a conversation.
Yep.
Every screening tool is limited by the 9 questions that you're asking. And, you know, if you pop positive and your primary care doc or the nurse in the office is able to identify, hey, this is something we should talk about a little bit more, that's great. The more important issue is people feeling comfortable talking to their healthcare provider about their mood status, about their sleep, about their memory. The more we talk about those things with our primary care resources, the better we're going to be at identifying these issues and really getting upstream and really hopefully have an impact on the tragedies, like you said, about this Dallas Cowboys football player. Just a tragic outcome and likely could have been prevented if we had been earlier to identify the issues.
You know, I just want to remind everybody that if you or someone you know is considering taking their own life, there's a suicide hotline that's very effective, and that's you just pick up a phone and dial 988. So please remember that crisis hotline. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to get back with my guest, Dr. Jim O'Day. We want to talk about anxiety and depression, and we're going to talk about seasonal affective disorder. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you again on this Saturday, November 8th. And our guest today is Dr. Jim O'Day. Jim, we touched on this a little bit, but among the most common mental health challenges, I think, in this country are anxiety and depression. Are these growing problems, or are we just recognizing them more?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked this question, Tony. I've got a couple thoughts about it. You know, one of the things that I would say is we've been concerned for really generations about the stigma associated with people seeking psychiatric care. And not that there was no silver lining in COVID. COVID was just tragic and terrible. I will say, though, that during the pandemic, it became actually more okay to talk about feeling depressed, feeling anxious, feeling apprehensive. In some way, because it was so common and it affected everyone during the pandemic, people actually became a little bit more comfortable talking about signs and symptoms of depression and anxiety. I think that's a positive thing. I think, however, that there are some real developmental issues in different populations. So, for example, I don't think it's actually more common in older generations, people in their, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. I think it's probably about the same as it's always been. Where it's alarming to me is with young people. Children, teenagers have access to some of the most powerful computers in the world in the palm of their hand. And what's happening with the advent of social media and the way that they have access to these tools that really induce people to really stay on their phone, decrease their social interaction. You know, we've seen such a decline in people participating in human endeavors and spending so much time on screen time that has clearly been correlated with a marked increase in eating disorders in young people, primarily girls, and also an increase in depression and anxiety in those under the age of 20 years old. So I'm actually quite concerned about that population. And I think, you know, from your perspective, you said earlier, you know, thinking of this as a real public health problem, this is a public health problem.
So when we look at it, do you think the system, the way we have it now, is equipped to deal and treat mental health problems effectively?
You know, I think part of the issue is almost posed in the question that we think about the mental health system is somehow separate from the healthcare system. And I think, you know, this goes back 1,000 years to the separation of the mind and the body. At the end of the day, we are full humans. And when we differentiate sort of somatic conditions that are associated with your bones or your heart, your liver, you know, we think about those things and we think about, you know, the brain condition. At the end of the day, these things have to be seen in the same way. So the more we integrate psychiatric care into primary care, the better off we're going to be. When we see them as separate issues, that results in delays in access to care. And the truth is, and I really want to emphasize this for the listeners, these conditions, depression, anxiety, substance use conditions, are actually very treatable, especially if we catch them early. So we really want to make sure we're doing a better job of bringing behavioral health into primary care, into other forms of specialty care. So it just becomes really normal to talk about your memory issues, your mood issues, your sleep disturbance. We just have to talk more about it. That's really the way forward.
Jim, I had a question came up this week, actually, in an email from Matt about seasonal affective disorder. And it was kind of interesting because I had a destination patient this week. I see some patients who fly in, and this particular patient came from Montana and kind of a remote area of Montana. And we got to talking about seasonal affective disorder, and he talked about how a lot of people living in his valley are now using ketamine, and it's been prescribed by their physician for seasonal affective disorder. And it was the first time I had heard of ketamine being used for that as a nasal application. But I wanted to back up. Are we seeing more seasonal affective disorder? And I never realized how big a problem it is in kind of remote areas where winter is really long for people. So can we talk about it kind of in general? I want to stay away from the medical treatment because I think there are a lot of other things people can do to get around it.
Yeah. First off, this is exactly the right time of year to be talking about this issue. The combination of the end of daylight savings time and the fact that we, especially in the northern climates, you go to a place where there is simply less time in the sun. So when it becomes darker a lot earlier, it's very clear seasonal affective disorder is a real biological condition. So if people are feeling they're not thinking clearly, their sleep is disturbed, they're feeling sad and down, they don't have any energy, the things that they used to get excited about leave them feeling flat, those are all signs and symptoms of a seasonal depression. And it's very real. And this is the time of year to be talking about it. The good news with this is it's quite, you know, for people who experience this condition, they actually know it. They know it's coming and they can prepare for it. But it really takes that level of preparation, like making sure that you're getting as much outdoor sunlight as you can during the waking hours. It also makes sure that people are getting exercise, good nutrition. But the other thing, Tony, that I think has demonstrated a lot of effectiveness is these light boxes. And, yeah. You know, there are people that really believe in this experience, you know, and they're modestly priced between the ages, you know, between the amount of, say, $50 to $80. You can get a high-quality light box, and you spend two 30-minute sessions in front of it during the day. I've had my patients have told me it has made a material impact on their mental health, their well-being during the winter months. So we can begin to prepare for this now and really begin to take strategies that will really have an impact on people's well-being all through these winter months.
You know, that's interesting because this summer I was in Norway and Iceland, and these light boxes are kind of standard equipment in people's rooms and or some variation thereof, in addition to everybody takes vitamin D supplements because, as many of you know, you really produce vitamin D from sunlight and getting exposure. So it's like standard equipment for living in these places where, I mean, they don't see sunlight for 2 to 3 months of the year.
Right.
So you could imagine the extreme for that. I want to shift gears a little bit.
Sure.
And that's about the more serious mental health problems we deal with, okay? I mean, people who have schizophrenia or things that require medication in addition to therapy. And I bring this up because there's this whole issue of homelessness in this country. And some people think the idea of homelessness is just, it goes away if you sweep them up and send them somewhere else. And we obviously know that that's not the solution. And the question gets raised of, is there a role for voluntary and temporary involuntary hospitalization for people who need regular medication, need treatment? And I comment this from the standpoint that you and I both remember Norwich State Hospital. And
sure.
I had a clinic out there. And, you know, it seems like an entire section of healthcare was destroyed from one movie, okay? One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And that wasn't necessarily the case in all of these situations. So I guess my question is there a place in the healthcare system specific to mental health where an inpatient facility where people can get their medication, they can get cognitive behavioral therapy, they can get 3 square meals a day, they are not living under a bridge. Is there a place for that, and should we be looking into that?
Yeah, first off, I have very strenuous views on this, Tony, so I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it for a second.
Sure.
So back in the 1960s and 1970s, there were probably 350 behavioral health psychiatric beds per 100,000 people in this country. People may be stunned to hear that that number went from 350 per 100,000 people to about 25 per 100,000 people. So what happened is this wave of closing long-term psychiatric hospitals where people were institutionalized, and that was probably something that clearly something we needed to do better. But we needed to replace those institutional beds with a community-based approach to care and treatment. And unfortunately, what's happened, this is, you know, some of the largest psychiatric facilities in this country are prisons. So we've closed all of these psychiatric beds across the country, and virtually for every psychiatric bed we have closed, we've opened a prison bed. So for all intents and purposes, we have largely criminalized a medical problem. And so not seeing this as a treatable medical condition, and instead allowing people to fend for themselves without the appropriate level of community-based supports, people end up doing petty crime. They get in over their head with breach of peace and disorderlies and failure to appear. And what ends up happening is we've criminalized a medical problem. So is there a need for inpatient psychiatric care? Of course there is, just like there's a need for intensive care, for progressive care units, for med-surg beds. We just have to think about building a continuum of care that recognizes that for short periods of time, somebody actually may need to be in a hospital. They may even need to be in a psychiatric hospital against their will for a short period of time until we can really begin to treat some of the thought disturbance, the things that place them in harm's way. What we really aspire to is a much more contemporary, more of a radical recovery approach to treatment, where there's full access to the continuum of care that naturally will involve some inpatient care at times. But really what we want is a community-based solution that offers humanistic, dignified approaches to housing and active treatment in our community.
You know, that was the promise when Norwich State Hospital was closed and the other state hospitals were closed. We were supposed to open these community centers where people can go every day to eat, get whatever they needed, get their medication. It's just that we forgot that part of the equation. And I use Norwich as the example because it's where you and I worked. And yeah, we saw what happened was these people had nowhere to go. So they were homeless on the streets. And when anything happened, they ended up in the emergency department. And that's probably the worst place because I saw our resources at Backus Hospital being devoted to taking care of mentally ill patients in the emergency department when we had more acute problems. Everybody was complaining. I had to wait 2 hours. I had to wait 3 hours. But we need to get out in front of these things. So I'm glad you feel that way. The next question is this. Do we prescribe medication too much or too little for mental health problems?
Yeah. We have to look at every single patient as an individual person and recognize that everybody sure needs individualized care. Generally speaking, I think there has become an over-reliance on medication options to address some of these issues. There's really good studies that the vast majority of people who are dealing with mild to moderate depression do just as well with short-term psychotherapy along with exercise, modifications to, you know, some of the behaviors in their life. I think we've stopped doing some of the common sense things. We've become a bit over-reliant on these medication approaches. The majority of people actually do quite well with a little bit of counseling and treatment. Some people need a combination of both. It's pretty rare that somebody's going to make the gains that they really can make just by focusing on medicine.
I've got a question that just came up. I won't use the name, but this is someone who said they are currently seeing a licensed clinical social worker for a mental health problem. And her question is, should I be seeing a psychologist instead, or should I be seeing a psychiatrist? So can you explain, I think it brings up a big question, can you explain the different roles of different professionals in the mental health system?
Sure, I can do that. First off, I appreciate that person asking these kind of questions. So the basic facts are psychiatrists are physicians. They've gone to medical school. Then they've done an additional 4 years of residency training in psychiatry. and then perhaps even a fellowship after that. So psychiatrists are medical professionals and are equipped to prescribe medicine. Many of them actually also do psychotherapy. Psychologists go down a different road. So they have usually a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, and then they pursue a PhD in psychology, and they have other resources and training as a way, but it really focuses on counseling and psychotherapy as the intervention, if you will. Licensed clinical social workers have master's degree, and they've also received very specialized training in providing psychotherapy and counseling. The more important issue is not the degree that the person has, MD, PhD, LCSW. The more important thing is, are they practicing evidence-based care? Are they actually following a kind of treatment that has rigor to it, that the science has showed that this is what works? And that's the question I would have whenever I encourage people to seek treatment. I always want them to make sure that they're following up with somebody who's providing evidence-based care and treatment, and not just somebody who got a degree and hangs a shingle and, you know, from word of mouth, people like them. You really want to make sure that somebody is that is practicing within the discipline that is providing, that is based in evidence, because evidence-based care really makes a difference. And that's, I think, the most important thing for people to focus on.
I think that that's great. And I think there are APRNs also, right, practice counseling as well. Okay.
Yep, that's exactly true. And those are, you know, typically registered nurses who themselves have gained additional training to become licensed in advanced practice. And there's some amazing APRNs who practice in psychiatry, and we use them frequently at Hartford Healthcare. I'm really proud of the diversity of our workforce that includes all of these disciplines.
I want to bring up a treatment issue, and probably people, some will remember it, but I'm asked often about the use of ECT versus transcranial magnetic stimulation. So electroconvulsive therapy, which is still very used very often, safely, and people get a great response to. But now we use transcranial magnetic stimulation. Can you talk a little bit about those modalities and how available they are?
Sure, I'd love to do that. Yeah, I think broadly, these are what we describe in the form of interventional psychiatry. And interventional psychiatry now includes a number of different kinds of treatment. As you say, we've always had ECT. And I want to be clear, ECT for the patient who needs it is absolutely a life-saving treatment, especially for older adults with what we call neurovegetative symptoms. So failure to thrive, they won't eat, they're sleeping all the time, at times become so depressed and unresponsive to treatment, they become nearly catatonic. ECT is a life-saving treatment. It's been poorly understood because of what people have seen in the media about it, but I really believe it is an evidence-based practice. Over the last couple of years, we've also found other forms of interventional psychiatry, and I really want to say I think the future is very bright for psychiatry. I think we're finally moving to a place where we better understand the conditions that we're treating, not so much a cluster of symptoms, but really personalized biotyping information. Psychiatry, frankly, is a little bit behind compared to, say, heart and vascular science, compared to cancer care. We essentially diagnose people with a cluster of symptoms, and I'll use an example. Some people say, well, the person may have depression. We're going to find in the coming years there's not one depression, that there's probably 40 different subtypes of depression, and we need to have a better evidence model for why someone is going to respond to this treatment versus that treatment. But I think interventional psychiatry, TMS as you describe, ECT, more recently esketamine and ketamine, these kind of interventions are going to be really the future of psychiatry. I think it's very promising, Tony.
Jim, the last time we had you on the show, we talked a lot about the Ridge Recovery Center. Can you bring people kind of up to speed on what the experience has been with that facility, which was new at the time in the Willimantic area?
Yeah, thanks for asking. We're just so proud of it, Tony. Again, this is back to evidence-based care and treatment. Medical withdrawal treatment followed up by rehabilitation care. The Ridge Recovery Center, over the last year and a half or so, has treated over 1,400 people, and the outcomes there are outstanding. You know, what we know is when people try to stop using drugs and alcohol on their own, it's very, very difficult to do. You know, for some people who do medical withdrawal treatment, often referred to as detox, you know, 3 to 4 days of abstinence, the likelihood of relapse is probably still as high as 75-80% in the next 3 months. But if you add in 2 to 3 weeks of residential care, the likelihood of relapse goes down to nearly less than 50%. So really the key issue is that if you can string together 3 months of sober living, the likelihood of improvement, first off, in your overall life is clearly going to make a difference. But we're just so proud of the work that we do at the Ridge Recovery Center. It's made a real difference in terms of access to care for many in our community. And I'm just really proud of the treatment team there.
How can people reach out to the Ridge? Do you have, I don't have the information right in. Oh, wait, I see it right here. Referrals, 877-307-4343. Is that a good number?
Yep, it is. And also people can find that at ridgerecovery.org as well. It's part of the Hartford healthcare system, and it's easy to find on the web. And we would really encourage people who, you know, those people who are listening today that are thinking, maybe I'm a little bit in over my head with my drinking, with my use of benzodiazepines, things like Ativan or Xanax. These are very treatable conditions. I'm hoping if somebody's listening to this and they think, you know what, maybe this is the prompt for me to do something about it, just call us today. We would love to help.
Jim, in closing, we got about 2 minutes. If you were to design the perfect mental health system for the United States, you had this magic wand, what would it look like?
Well, first off, it would start with the kind of education that you've done on Saturdays. The more we learn, the more we learn about all these conditions, how treatable they are, Tony, the better off our communities are going to be. So again, I think our audience, this audience owes a great thank you to you for all of what you've done for these 16 years. In terms of the magic wand, it's about integrating behavioral health care into all of health care. This whole mind-body separation has been a problem. And so if people are talking about their hypertension and their sleep issues and their aches and pains with their primary care doctor, they should also be talking about their mood and their anxiety. The more we normalize talking about it, the sooner people will get care. The sooner people get care, the better they will be.
Jim, thank you. Thank you for your time today, and thanks for everything you've done and for being so available to us over here at Healthy Rounds. Thanks again, Jim.
You're welcome, sir. See you, Tony.
All right. See you, buddy. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Many thanks to Dr. Jim O'Day for spending time with us today. And many thanks to Kevin Corza, who's been on the board. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week, we're going to have a taped program. I'll have a new introduction and close, but there will be a taped interview since I will be, well, for Yankee fans, I'll be in enemy territory. I will be at Fenway Park with the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, and they will be playing against the Merchant Marine Academy, so I will be on their sideline. If you have any questions about today's program or you want to continue the conversation, just go to info@alessimd.com. You can get the Healthy Rounds podcast by just going to odyssey.com. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.